Yesterday, an estimated 300 to 350 million people were said to sit down and watch at least some of the coronation of England's Charles III. Global numbers these days are hard to measure, given the way people watch these things, but it could have been even higher or possibly lower, still waiting for the final tally to come in. Now, that may seem like an impressive figure, but to be honest, it is modest in comparison to other globally attractive events. Some even claim over 4 billion people watched Queen Elizabeth's funeral last September, though there are plenty who dispute that number. And I think for understandable reasons, 4 billion is a very high number. Though you might be surprised to learn that the highest confirmed audience ever was 3.6 billion people who settled down or settled in to watch the opening ceremony of the 1996 Olympic Games in Atlanta, which would have been a big event. But if I had to put my money on it, I never would have guessed that one to be the top, the number one. But that's apparently the case. In any event, the prediction over the past few days was that fewer than usual would witness this, and early data coming in seems to confirm that. Apparently, in the United Kingdom, audience peaked at around 20 million, and that is about 30% lower than the number of people who saw the final farewell to Elizabeth. But anyway, it was a coronation, there was a crowning, and by that I mean Charles and Camilla wore crowns. Now, this is a striking difference from Spanish tradition because the Spanish do not crown their monarchs. They actually proclaim them, and it's been like that for centuries, about 600 years actually. The last king to be crowned in Castile, for example, was Juan I, all the way back in 1379. So this business of putting a crown on a king's head or a queen's head has not been done in this country for centuries. However, a physical crown is present at the ceremony when a new Spanish monarch is proclaimed, but it lies on a kind of a velvety cushion next to the king or queen, but it is not worn. As we know, in the UK, things are done differently, and at this coronation, Charles was actually seen wearing two crowns, two different crowns. First, the main crown, the one that was used during the actual coronation ceremony. It was known as, or is known as, St. Edward's crown. Its origin goes all the way back to the 13th century, I believe. The current one was made in 1661, and I have to admit, it's a magnificent piece. Charles, though, did not depart from the premises of Westminster Abbey with that crown. Instead, he was given a second headpiece known as the Imperial State Crown, and is probably more familiar to people who follow these things. It is commonly associated with the monarch. It also weighs half of what St. Edward's crown is, making it far more comfortable and amenable. From the way I'm saying this, you might get the feeling that this is sort of a second-rate crown, not quite up there with the big one, but the Imperial State Crown is no slouch. It boasts a dazzling 2,868 diamonds, including the massive Cullinan II diamond, and that's at the base of the front of the crown. It's probably the enormous red gem inset right above that diamond that gets our attention more often because that red color tends to stand out to us. And it's that stone that interests us for our purposes because it's one of the oldest pieces of the crown jewels, and its provenance is none other than Spain, or Castile to be more exact. So let me tell you a little bit more about this. This jewel is known as the Black Prince Ruby. And the first thing that must be clarified is that it isn't a ruby at all, but rather a similar gem called a spinel. Rubies are slightly harder and arguably a little bit more valuable, but they are very similar. But it wasn't until the 18th century that experts were able to differentiate them, which is why so many spinels are informally known as rubies, as is the case here. Now, as I was telling you, this ruby came from Spain, but that's not really true. It's actually from a different part of the world. Many people say it probably came from a mine in a region in what is today Afghanistan, though I must add that there are some recent studies that have linked it to a location in the country of Myanmar. That is what the experts have to say about that, and I'm in no position to question any of that information. What seems clear is that it came from Asia, and it eventually made its way into the hands of the ruler of the Emirate of Granada, the final Muslim kingdom in Spain, the same kingdom that Fernando and Isabel would finally remove in 1492. We are now talking about the middle of the 14th century, and at that time, Granada's ruler, a man named Mohammed VI, was struggling to hold on to power. So in 1362, he went to the King of Castile, a controversial figure called Pedro I, often known as Pedro the Cruel, and asked for help. It wasn't a good idea in retrospect if the story that has reached us to this day is true, because upon meeting Pedro, the king, the Castilian king, had him and his followers killed on the spot. So it wasn't a successful meeting at all. Then they sort of rummaged through the robes and found the stone and naturally kept it. Pedro would not hold on to it for very long, which is why when you sometimes read that this belonged to Castile, it wasn't in Castile's hands for very long. The reason being the 14th century was a complicated time for Spain. They were turbulent times for the different regions in general, no matter where you lived. Civil strife and even civil war was constant. And so it was during this very same period that Pedro was also trying to defend his place as King of Castile from a challenge by his half-brother. And they were fighting for supremacy of the kingdom. For a number of very good reasons, Pedro worried that he wouldn't have enough resources to overcome his enemy, so he sought help from the King of England, Edward III, with whom he had struck up an alliance. Edward sent his son, the Prince of Wales, also called Edward, but in this case, Edward of Woodstock. He is often called the Black Prince, even though that special name would not be used for a couple of centuries. Anyway, this Edward of Woodstock was one of the most well-known military commanders of the time. We are talking about the period of the Hundred Years' War. So, if we are to believe what they say about history here, Pedro pretty much promised the prince just about anything in return for his aid, money, future kingdoms, his daughters, they all sort of acted as collateral. And despite any guarantee of payment, Edward of Woodstock agreed and brought an army into Spain. He fulfilled his side of the deal by helping Pedro defeat Enrique at the Battle of Nájera in 1367. And after that, Edward took his army to Burgos and he waited outside of the city in a monastery called Las Huelgas, next to that monastery, and he waited for his compensation. After a few weeks, he began to suspect that King Pedro was never going to make good on his promises. And while he was waiting and hoping to settle the debt, food became scarce, and the summer began to settle in, as well as the extreme heat, and his soldiers became very ill, as did he. For the most part, he was so frustrated, that he gave up waiting and left the country disappointed and with an army depleted of troops. He did, however, take two of Pedro's daughters with him and married them off to relatives in England. That is a story in itself, not one for today. And he also supposedly took the stone, which either Pedro gave to him as a kind of compensation, or another version says Edward pretty much snatched it away. But the important thing is the ruby, the spinel, appears to have entered the treasure chest of England at this time and in this manner. Edward would never become king. He died young. And as I told you before, at that time, he was not known as the Black Prince. And many people feel they called him that later on because of the black armor he would wear. His legacy is still with us to this day. And the Black Prince ruby appeared several decades later in 1415. This time it was King Henry V and his forces faced the French at the Battle of Agincourt. That's right, the legendary Battle of Agincourt. Basically, thanks mainly to the longbows used by the English, the French and the French nobility were practically slaughtered that day. Henry V rode into battle, protected by a helmet covered with gemstones, including the Black Prince's ruby. As extravagant as that may seem, the hard-to-break gems may have actually provided a little more protection for the king that day, and I think protection that he needed, and the ruby itself also survived. 70 years later, another king, Richard III, also wore it on a helmet during the Battle of Bosworth, but his fate was decidedly less positive. He was killed on the field of battle, and once again, though, the ruby managed to survive. That was in 1485, I believe, sometime around then. And then a few decades later, the mention of a very large ruby, a Balas ruby, as they called it, was mentioned when they were sort of doing an inventory. Henry VIII now, we're talking about Henry VIII, did an inventory of the royal jewels, and it is pretty much assumed by experts that it must be the same one. The stone made it through another crisis when Oliver Cromwell's Commonwealth tried to do away with many of the symbols of royalty and much of the royal treasure. But once again, fortune was on the side of the ruby, and Charles II in the early 1660s recovered the piece. We next find out about it in the 19th century when it was included in a crown that Queen Victoria wore. And then in 1919, it was incorporated into the imperial state crown and has been there ever since. Aside from the immense diamond, the Cullinan II diamond, this is basically the star of that headpiece. And there you have it. History being made this weekend in the United Kingdom, but with a bit of Spanish history playing a small part in it all. And that will be all for today from Brian Spain Domain. We hope you've enjoyed the podcast. Feel free to leave us any comments because we love the feedback. You can subscribe to our podcast on Spotify, Apple, Amazon, or Castos. Or if you wish to support Brian Spain Domain, we'd greatly appreciate it. We work very hard to provide you with the best information about Spain, Spanish history, and Spanish culture. You can do so by clicking on our PayPal donate button, or if you want to have access to absolutely all of our podcasts and support us regularly, you can check us out on Patreon at the link provided below. Stay well, stay safe, and hasta pronto.